How do you answer the question, who are you? Sure, you can give name and occupation and age and interests and so on, but is that what makes up the self? We struggle with the concept of the self. Is it something the brain does? Is it something society places upon us? All of the above? Science struggles with this as much as any individual, and the struggle is recounted in the book The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. Anil Ananthaswamy is the author of the book. He's a science journalist, currently a consultant to New Scientist and the former deputy editor there. He's won awards for his writing and teaches a science journalism workshop at the National Center for Biological Sciences in Bangalore, India. He splits his time between Bangalore and Berkeley, California. Anil Ananthaswamy, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey. My pleasure.
What was the starting point for this book?
Oh, the starting point probably goes back a few decades for me. I've been interested in the issue of the self, just questions of who am I for a while now. And it's only when I started writing, professionally, and I started thinking about a way of getting into the story of the self that I began to think about this particular book. And that kind of began about 4 or 5 years ago.
I understand you were exposed to a fair number of religious traditions in your youth, which might have helped this process along a bit.
Yeah, I grew up in India, and as you will know, the major religions in India, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, they are all concerned at their very sort of philosophical core, they are concerned about the nature of the self, the question, who am I? And their theologies kind of, spring forth from their particular answers to that question.
Does it seem to you, from the research you've done for this book, that that religion seems to have more ready answers than science does for what the self is?
They have their answers. I think science is trying to come at it from an empirical evidence-based approach, trying to understand mechanistically what's happening. I think at this point, religions, they definitely have answers. There's no way of saying who's right, who's wrong at this point, but I am personally scientifically inclined, so I kind of like the scientific approach to understanding the self, and it's also interesting to see whether there are any kind of commonalities between what religions have come up with as their answers, philosophers, what they are saying, and what science is saying. I think there's definitely many areas of commonality there.
Are there lots of commonalities across cultures as well for people to answer the question, who am I?
Yes, there are. I mean, I think, at some very basic level, in your introduction, you kind of alluded to that. Like, when you ask someone, who are you, you're probably going to get a narrative answer. You're going to get a story out of them. They're going to tell you, I grew up here, I was born there, I'm so-and-so, I do this kind of work. So it's a story we have in our heads about who we are. It's a story we tell others. It's a story we tell ourselves. It's just something that seems to persist in our heads, and that's that's common across cultures. I don't think you're unlikely to go to any culture and not find this kind of response to the question. From a neuroscientific point of view, of course, or even from certain sort of theological perspectives like Buddhism and, Hinduism, the self can be examined in a much more fine-grained manner than just the kind of narrative that we are. And that's the question I explore in this book. Like, when you really want to answer the question, who am I, or what is that I that we're talking about, that becomes the real question. And that's not just the narrative.
Anil, before we go too much further, you just mentioned the term neuroscience. And it seems like we've talked about it so much in recent years that there's a bit of a backlash to it now. When we talk about neuroscience, what are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about our nervous system and the science of the central nervous system, or the entire nervous system that we have, the brain, and it's not just the brain, but the nervous system, goes into the body. So, basically, the brain-body complex, as it pertains to the nervous system.
The case studies in the book are fascinating, and you write of patients suffering from depersonalization. Is that a common thing?
So none of these disorders are, that I write about or conditions are common in, except maybe, the ones that we know about really are things like Alzheimer's and schizophrenia. Depersonalization definitely is not very common, but it does occur in populations. People do suffer from it. It's a condition in which you kind of feel slightly detached from your own body and your emotions. You feel like you're living in a dream state. And most of us would have kind of transiently experienced this occasionally. Usually people who have severe jet lag will feel like this for a day or so. They kind of feel disconnected with everything. Things around them feel a bit unreal. They themselves feel unreal to themselves, which is kind of a strange way of saying it, but that's we kind of struggle with words when we try to describe these conditions. But you can imagine that if this becomes chronic, if this is how you feel day in, day out, it's quite distressing, and people do get very anxious and have panic attacks because of this.
I wonder, in the case you cite, though, with jet lag, if that happens more often when they're landing in a strange place, if that's why they feel disconnected from themselves and everything else.
It could be partly that, but, you know, I travel back and forth between two very familiar places, so to me it's not the strangeness of the place. I think there's something just about the fact that you have jet lag, which is a kind of a physiological change that has happened to your body. Your body is adjusting to, you know, the timing has been thrown off for your own body, and that seems to have that effect. So part of it could be what you're saying, that if you just end up in a strange new place, you will have that feeling of unreality. But it could happen if you're just going to, you know, a place that you call home, and it'll still happen.
Does science, either of the mind or body, have a clear definition of self?
The definition of a self is really the key issue here when we talk of, you know, the debate that neuroscientists are having about whether there is a self or whether there is no self, or when philosophers argue about it. So it really depends on how you slice and dice the self. And, you know, we talked of the narrative self. The self also has a bodily component. So there's no one definition. You really have to kind of nail down what you're talking about before you start debating it.
All right, that's the basis for the discussion here. The book is called The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. Anil Ananthaswamy is our guest. He's the author of the book. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return from this break. Back with Anil Ananthaswamy and you in a minute 15. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the self. The self, well, here again, we have trouble just defining it right off the bat, which is the point of the book, The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. Anil Ananthaswamy is our guest and its author on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us as well to talk about your concept of the self and how you would define this, and if you've had issues with delineating what yourself is as opposed to other people or stuff around you. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The specific cases you begin with are fascinating from the get-go, particularly the people who think they are dead or brain dead. What's going on there?
So this is something called Cotard syndrome, right? It's a syndrome that was identified in the late 1800s by a French doctor called Jules Cotard, so it's named after him. It's a constellation of symptoms. You know, it's people sometimes feel like some part of their body is missing. They're missing their teeth or uterus or stomach or things like that. But the most striking symptom that characterizes Cotard's is this feeling that they don't exist, that they're already dead, and it's not something that you can argue with them about. It is a perception. It's a delusion, but it's a very, very convincing delusion for them.
Does it arise organically? Do we know the causes of Cotard syndrome?
It can happen organically. I mean, it seems to be very comorbid with depression. People who have Cotard's are also very severely depressed sometimes. Brain injury can cause it, but basically it seems to be that some parts of their brain which are responsible for awareness of your own body and body states and thoughts about yourself, those networks that are constantly active in all of us, in people with Cotard's, they are very, very underactive. They seem to be suppressed in activity. So it might be that they're not perceiving, in some very loose way of speaking, they're not perceiving themselves really vividly, and that kind of leads to the perception of not existing.
And the specific patients you cite give some really interesting answers. I mean, you know, when the medical professionals are trying to work with them and point out, well, you're not brain dead, obviously, because you can answer questions and carry on a conversation with me. But they always seem to deny.
I mean, that's exactly a case that no amount of rational discussion is going to snap them out of that. You can, like, the doctors will try and bring them to the point of surrendering to logic, but it doesn't work. Their perception, their internal perception of not existing is extremely convincing to them, so they will argue against you. You know, they'll accept all that you're saying. Look, I eat, I sleep, I, you know, I do all the things that I used to, but I'm dead. Or in this particular case that I write about, he's very convinced that his mind is alive because he's having the conversation with the doctor, but he's brain dead.
Which certainly challenges the view that the mind is what the brain does, but that's a different book
and
a different day.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the doctor that I talked to was pointing out, this is an extreme form of dualism that comes across when you talk to a patient who's claiming to be, whose mind is alive but brain is dead, but it is a delusion in Cotard's, very, very severe delusion.
And you muse, Anil, about Cotard syndrome in the context of René Descartes. How do those two things challenge each other?
Well, I mean, you know, Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, and Cotard's really makes you wonder, right? I mean, here is someone who's thinking, but is saying, I don't. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, are they saying, I think, therefore I'm not? So in some sense, it's a direct challenge to Descartes' philosophy. I mean, it's fair to say now that Descartes' ideas of, you know, I think, therefore I am, and his mind-body dualism, neuroscience has moved away from it. Philosophers have also moved away from it. But it did rule Western philosophy for a long time. And you know, and Cotard's really just throws a spanner in the works.
The Cotard's gets us to a discussion of the physical sense of the self. I mean, are we very much tied to our bodies as they currently exist? And if for example we lose parts through amputation or surgery or something, that we think of ourselves differently?
So it really, again, like we were discussing, you know, it really depends on what aspect of the self one is talking about. So one of the things that became clear to me as I was writing this book was that the perception of the body is one aspect of the self, my bodily self. And so in the case of Cotard's, like, you can take this idea that, you know, the Cotard's patient is saying, I don't exist. Whereas most of us, hopefully, our listeners are, you know, we're all saying, I exist. What's interesting here is that in both cases, all of us who are saying I exist versus the person with Cotard's who's saying I don't exist, what's important is the I. There is an I that is claiming either to exist or to not exist. And the real sort of philosophical neuroscientific challenge and question is to answer the question, who or what is that I that is, you know, it doesn't matter that it's saying I don't exist, but there is still an I that is making that claim. Who is that I? And that becomes sort of the quest in the book. And so when it comes to the bodily self, you know, you can look down at your body and feel like every part of your body is yours, or in certain conditions you can feel like some part of your body is not yours. But there is still an I. Again, you come back to that same thing. There is still an I that is either aware of owning all its body parts or having the feeling that some body part is not their own. So again, what is that I? And that's the self that one is after.
What is that I? That is a very, very tall question. Anil Ananthaswamy takes it up in the book, The Man Who Wasn't There. Jeannie in Medford is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello. I think you addressed partly my question about amputation. I have two friends, one missing an arm and one missing a leg. And somehow science was studying that if they somehow visual look in a mirror, you know, where the reverse is, if image is reversed, the brain perceives it as they do have that leg. And they were trying to help with phantom pain.
Right.
And I'll listen off to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeannie.
Yeah, so Jeannie is referring to this whole phenomenon called phantom limbs. When somebody has had an amputation, many people will report, at least for some time after the amputation, still feeling the limb that they had. And for some people, it doesn't go away, and that can also be the cause of pain in this, you know, non-existent limb. sometimes the limb is stuck in some awkward position in their perception, and because the physical limb is not there, they can't sort of change that position anymore. It's just stuck in some way. So what that's telling you is that the limb that you're perceiving, that you think is your own and that you're aware of, is actually not the physical limb, but a representation of the limb in the brain. And in the case of an amputation, the representation should reorganize and basically it should go away because the physical limb has gone. So this is one way of thinking about what might be happening in the brain. But sometimes the representation doesn't go away and you're stuck with a limb that is non-existent and it can be the source of pain. And one way to get that limb unstuck is to kind of look in the mirror, look at the other limb, but when you look into the mirror, it looks like the limb that has been amputated, and then you move, the limb that you still have, but look while you're looking into the mirror, and somehow that helps the brain reorganize its maps, and you can get the non-existent limb unstuck. So it's quite a phenomenal experiment that's been done and shown to be effective.
But then there's the flip side of this, from not just the people who have had amputations, but this other thing you identify in the book called body integrity identity disorder. What goes on there?
So it's in some sense the exact opposite problem, right? I mean, in phantom limbs, you have a non-existent limb that you perceive. But what would happen if you have a fully functional, healthy limb, but you perceive it as not being yours? So it's kind of the converse problem, where the limb is functioning, but somehow the representation of the limb in the brain is messed up a little bit. And, some aspect of the representation, in this case, the sense of ownership you have of all your body parts, which is, again, some sort of information in the brain, that has gone slightly wrong. So ideally, if everything is working well, then your physical body and the maps in the brain that your brain creates of your own body, they should match up, they should be congruent. And sometimes things go slightly awry and there's a mismatch. And so you end up with body integrity identity disorder, where you're looking at your limb. Intellectually, in every which way, you know it's a healthy, functioning limb and it's your limb in terms of knowing. But actually, the way it feels, it doesn't feel like your limb, and it can be quite debilitating for people who are suffering from it.
Tell us about the rubber hand test at the University of Pittsburgh, Anil, because that's a really interesting exploration into this disorder.
Yeah, so the rubber hand illusion was done in the late 90s. It's a very, very simple experiment. So what you do is you sit on at a table. You put your left hand on the table, relaxed, sit very relaxed, and then get a rubber hand, which you can buy from Amazon for $5. It's things that people who practice polishing nails, they can buy it for that. So you just buy it and set that rubber hand next to your real hand and put a screen between the two so that you can only see the rubber hand. You can't see your real hand. Now have someone, your friend, take two paintbrushes and start brushing both your real hand and the rubber hand at the same speed, at the same spots on the two hands. So if your friend is brushing the index finger on your real hand, he should be brushing the index finger on the rubber hand. So the key here is that you're not able to see your real hand, but you're only watching the rubber hand. And I can bet you that in about two-thirds of the people who go through this experiment, in about 2 minutes, you're going to feel something very, very strange, which is that the sense of touch that you had been feeling on your real hand will shift to the location of the rubber hand. It's as if the brain, which has been looking at the rubber hand, so you have two inputs coming into your brain. One is the sight, you're looking at the rubber hand being stroked with a paintbrush, and the other sensation is the sense of touch on your real hand. So there are two sensations, and it's conflicting information for the brain, and it somehow decides, it must be coming from the place where the rubber hand is because I'm feeling the touch. And because our visual sensations take priority over a lot of other sensations that are coming into the body, it basically says, okay, my hand must be at the location of the rubber hand. And you start feeling touch at the location of the rubber hand. It's a very, very bizarre feeling. The brain takes ownership of the rubber hand.
Wow, that's amazing. We have a rubber hand at home. I have to try this out. The book is called The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. Anil Ananthaswamy is its author and our guest on The Exchange. You get into the self as subject and self as object. How do you differentiate those?
So one way of thinking about it is, when we talked of Cotards, for instance, we talked of this feeling of I don't exist. So you can just in terms of a sentence structure, you can see that existence out there is the object, and I is the subject. So so the self as subject here is the I. Self as object is the feeling of existence or non-existence. You can similarly say I feel happy or I feel sad. Your happiness or sadness is very much a part of yourself at any moment in time. At the moment that you're experiencing it. But if you really think about that sentence and the way it's constructed, it becomes very clear that happiness or sadness is a state of yourself, is an aspect of yourself at that point, and that's kind of the self as object, which keeps changing. What is unchanging here is the self as subject, which is the I that is experiencing either being happy or being sad or anything in between or something else entirely. So all of the various things, like even your own body, when you say, I feel like this body is mine, again, the feeling of body ownership is part of the self as object, because that can change. Like we just talked about the rubber hand illusion, in 2 minutes before the illusion sets in, you have ownership of your real hand. And once the illusion sets in, suddenly you have ownership of the rubber hand. So something about the bodily self has changed. You suddenly have a rubber hand within your bodily self. But what hasn't changed is the I that is experiencing that. There was an I before which experienced the real hand as being its own, and that's the self as subject. And then 2 minutes later, the same I now, the self as subject, is experiencing a different object as part of its self. So that's the difference. That's how I sort of split the two. It's not my, it's not something that I have come up with. This is what philosophers talk about. And I use that as a way to kind of analyze what might be happening in conditions that disrupt the self. And then you keep asking that question. So what is this self as subject? What is this I? Where does that come from?
And you get into among the conditions that can disrupt the sense of self, Alzheimer's disease. I mean, much changes, but you really delve into individual cases and raise the overall question of, do you stop being you with Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah, and it's a profound question that actually we need to answer somehow, because we need to understand what might be happening and in late stage Alzheimer's. So anyone who has been around someone with Alzheimer's or takes care of someone with Alzheimer's knows that by mid to late stages, one of the things that's going away is the person's, the memory is definitely going away. But what also is very clear is that their narrative self, the story that they are, which is completely dependent on memory, both on memory formation and the retention of old memories, that part of oneself is getting eroded. And of course, other cognitive abilities go alongside, your ability to take care of yourself, to brush your teeth, to put on clothes, all of these things are going away. So, and what becomes apparent to caregivers is when they're interacting with someone with late-stage Alzheimer's, they don't perceive as if there is anyone in there, that there is no self anymore. They'll say things like, oh, that person I knew is gone, he or she is no more, that the self has, disappeared. And the question scientists are raising, and the question that I address in that chapter on Alzheimer's, is that, has the self gone away in its entirety just because the story that we are is going away? Does it mean that there is no one remaining that can feel other perceptions like hunger or pain or whatever else that might be happening as their own? Is there no one? So in some sense, because we just talked of the self as subject, is there no self as subject remaining? And we don't know the answer to that when it comes to Alzheimer's, because people with late-stage Alzheimer's, unfortunately, are unable to tell us what it must be like for them. But as, science goes, we really need, it's the onus is on science to tell us what might be happening, because then we'll take care of people with Alzheimer's in a certain way once we understand, if, for instance, you were really sure that some aspect of the person still remains, we will have far more empathy and we'll worry about it a lot more than if we keep saying there is no one in there. And so it's something we really need to figure out.
Ah, so suddenly a medical and scientific reason for trying to maintain some semblance of the wrapping of the self is important, because otherwise you're just going to throw people into rooms and say they don't care. They're not really here.
Well, I mean, and it's also interesting that, you know, normally when what happens with Alzheimer's is that, you know, we take people away from their context, which is the home that they're, you know, the house that they're living in, their family, and put them into care homes, which, I mean, there are valid reasons for doing all that, but at the same time, it's a completely alien environment. And it turns out that a lot of what we are is not just cognitive, that even if we're just talking of the narrative self, the story that we are, that story is also in our bodies. And our bodies function and remember what we are in familiar circumstances. You put the body in an unfamiliar place and it loses part of its ability to be a narrative. So I think this is also something to think about with Alzheimer's.
Much more to think about, much more to talk about with Anil Ananthaswamy. He's the author of The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. We'll return to struggling with the concept of the self and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the science journalist Anil Ananthaswamy, who splits his time between Bangalore, India, and Berkeley, California. His latest book is called The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. And we're struggling with how science does approach the sense of self and how we as individuals do as well. Do things like amputations and or wishing we had amputations make a difference in how we view our whole selves? What is the whole self? And we're also learning about situations like Cotard syndrome, where people think they are dead. We're at the moment talking about Alzheimer's. You can join our discussion on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the idea of Alzheimer's and the self, I mean, you spend a fair amount of time on this in the book, but you also introduce us once again to patient HM. And tell us about what his story teaches us about the self.
Well, HM was a, you know, he had epileptic seizures when he was very young, and he was operated upon. Some parts of his brain were taken out. This was a long, long time ago. And it turned out the operation resulted in him having retrograde amnesia. So he essentially forgot everything about, you know, who he was in terms of his narrative, and his short-term memory formation also sort of got disrupted. He wouldn't remember things that just happened to him, 5 minutes ago. So what it really started teaching us was about memory systems, the various kinds of memory systems that we have. We have declarative memory, procedural memory. So in a sense, what HM really gave us were insights into how memory functions. And Alzheimer's, in some sense, is telling us even more now about, what's happening with our memory. It essentially, in the first thing Alzheimer's does is it stops new memories from forming. So in some sense, if you think about who we are, the narrative part of ourselves, the stories that we are, it depends entirely on us remembering everything that has happened to us. So if something is happening, like for instance, I'm on your radio show. For me, this is a significant event. I will remember it, and it becomes part of my narrative. I will be able to narrate this 10 years from now to someone who's to whom I'm telling a story. But what if this particular episode in my life could not get incorporated into my bank of memories about myself? And that seems to be what's happening in Alzheimer's, and it begins like that. New memories stop forming, and then it actually starts eroding existing memories. So it starts scrambling your narrative. Your ordering of events that made up your life start getting messed up, and eventually they kind of seem to completely go away.
I have joked with people as I get older that if a memory got into my head before age 40, it'll probably stay. Anything since that time is on somewhat shakier ground. And then you bring up something called the reminiscence bump.
Yes, it's a very well-known psychological phenomenon that there is, if you were to try and recollect memories from your life, you're more likely to remember things that happened between the ages of about 15 to 25 or 10 to 30. That it's the range is kind of little, you know, it stretches in people. But basically, the most important memories are the memories that formed during your teenage, you know, years, adolescence, and early adulthood, and they are very, very important for your sense of who you are. So the densest parts of your life are, you know, in terms of memories, are those years, and it's true for, you know, people across cultures, and it seems to be really something very, very solid, this reminiscence bump.
So this is a function of what the brain does? Is this what the, do we know this much from neuroscience?
It is definitely something that the brain does, and it might be because, you know, because we are at that age where we're really forming our identity, that a lot of these events have very, very high emotional significance. And you know, you can, you know, if you try to think about the things that you remember most, they're most likely going to be the things that have had the most emotional impact on you. And it turns out that we are very, very prone to having, you know, highly emotional events happening during adolescence and early adulthood for reasons we understand. I mean, it's, you know, partly hormonal, and these are significant. We are sort of growing up and becoming the persons that we are, that we will be in our adulthood during those years. So those are significant events.
Let us take a call. We have Jamie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Anil Ananthaswamy. His book is The Man Who Wasn't There.
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. First of all, a personal anecdote. I have a, back about 30 years ago, I had a rear-end car accident. And every so often, the muscle mass down the right lower lumbar of my spine occasionally gives me a little twinge to go like, especially when I'm in kind of a hazardous situation, it just kind of like twinges a little bit, and it takes me back like 30 years ago, but the point of it is that my muscle still remembers that happened, mm-hmm. And when a circumstance that's kind of coincidental to that occurs, it reminds me of that, which is leading me to my question. Could the author address the concept of muscle memory and, more importantly, the idea of gut instinct, which is like, we have cliches for it, like, I don't have a good feeling about this, there's something in my gut that tells me that there's something wrong, and basically, perhaps our mind isn't exactly all stuck up inside of our heads, so to speak. It just exists throughout the entire part of our whole self.
Okay, so yeah, more about the self being spread throughout the body. Thanks for that, Jamie. Appreciate it. Anil, what do you say?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question, and it actually ties in very well with you know, some things we were talking about with Alzheimer's. You know, there is this traditional notion, again, going back to Descartes, that somehow the mind is separate from the body, and it's a concept that even, you know, permeates discussions of selfhood. When we think of who we are, we think that all of that is somehow cognitive, that it necessarily involves conscious recall of things that have happened to us. And when we narrate a story, we think it's just in the telling of the story, cognitively, from our minds. But, you know, what the caller is telling us, that look, there's a lot of what we are that is embodied, that is actually the stories have gotten into our body. In his case, it's the memory of a traumatic event that, you know, comes up every now and then and reminds him that, oh, okay, this happened. You can take something much more innocuous, like learning how to ride a bicycle. Now, learning how to ride a bicycle, if you learned it, is part of your narrative. It's who you are. And you can't take that away from, you know, the story that you are. But it's not a story that you can consciously recall. It's basically what your body knows how to do. The more we understand about the self, the more we are realizing that the body is an extremely important part of selfhood, that you cannot separate the body from the self in any kind of fundamental way. In fact, it's the opposite. The body is fundamental to the self. Everything that we are starts with the bodily self. The bodily self has to be functioning properly in order for us to be a healthy cognitive self. And the link is inextricable. I mean, they're really very tightly coupled.
We have an email here from Sheila in Eugene who writes about depersonalization disorder, you know, a sense in which people don't feel like they are real. And she asks, what brings about depersonalization and what is a solution and how important is being validated by others?
Well, in terms of what, you know, what brings it about, again, there are some studies. It's not something that has been studied extensively in terms of looking at what's happening in the brain, but there are, again, some studies that give us hints about what might be happening. And it seems like the part of the brain that has to put together or integrate all the various streams of sensations that are coming into the body from the outside and from within, to kind of integrate all of that and create a perception of one's own body, one's own emotional state, and allow you to experience that state vividly and with clarity, that part of the brain seems to be slightly underactive for reasons that are not entirely understood. And in some sense, because you're lacking that vividness, it feels like, oh, I'm separated from my emotions, that somehow there is a distance between my bodily self, my emotions, and the I, the self as subject that we keep talking about. So that then leads to this kind of feeling of living in a dream state. And it's actually very distressing. It seems to be an evolutionary adaptation that we have to deal with danger. At least that's one of the arguments that's put forward, that the ability to kind of distance yourself from something distressing emotionally that is happening. Say you're about to be in a car accident. People have reported suddenly kind of feeling that they're separated from their emotions and their body, and they can watch everything happening and somehow still do whatever needs to be done. And it seems like we have that ability to get into that state. Now, once you accept that our brain and body has, you know, they have that ability, then we may also be prone to get into that state chronically because of, you know, just circumstances. In terms of how to treat that, it's an ongoing thing. We really don't understand it. There are some drugs that are usually used for treating convulsions in epilepsy that have some effect on depersonalization, but it doesn't work in everyone. And it's still ongoing. People are still trying to figure it out.
The discussion of the car accident example triggers another couple of thoughts here, which is the way that we do tend to think of, like, I had to leave my body for myself to survive. But there's the key right there. It's like the self can be intact without the body, at least for brief periods, is the way people view it.
That's the intuitive feeling that comes about. Again, it brings about a sense of duality, doesn't it? But it's actually not. Nothing is leaving the body. So the question of what that I is, how does the sense of being a subject come about from, you know, the activity of the brain is still a kind of difficult and unanswered question. It's a very elusive quarry philosophically and scientifically at this point. But let's, you know, if you assume that somehow even the self as subject, the sense of the I, comes about because of brain activity, once that I then has to be located in a certain body, and the brain works really hard to, you know, like every moment it is essentially integrating all the sensations to locate that sense of I within this geometric volume that is the body, and sometimes that calculation goes wrong and that I ends up, you know, outside, geometrically speaking, so nothing actually is leaving the body. It's at least from a scientific perspective, it's very clear that nothing is leaving the body. It seems to be a misfiring of certain mechanisms in the brain that otherwise locate that I within the body. They just end up locating it outside the body.
Schizophrenia certainly comes up in the book, The Man Who Wasn't There, and you describe a staggering array of symptoms and then ego disturbances, schizophrenia has been called. But you did talk to several people who went through schizophrenic episodes, and was there any commonality there about what they said about their sense of self and, for example, where the voices came from?
So they can't tell you where the voices are coming from. All they can tell you is they're hearing voices, and those voices don't feel like their own. They feel like someone else's voices. Someone else is speaking to them or about them, and they certainly don't feel like their voices. And that's the key issue here, that there's something in my head that doesn't feel like mine. It could be thoughts, it could be voices. They also feel kind of a blurring of body boundaries. They can sort of say that, oh, I extend my arm and it seems to kind of just keep extending, and the boundaries that we normally feel between our bodily self and the outside world kind of start disintegrating a little bit. They also sometimes feel a lack of sense of agency. So if you were to pick up a cup that's on your table right now, you will have a distinct sensation that you are doing that, that it's your action, and you don't even have any doubts about it. It's not something you think about. It's an implicit feeling. And in schizophrenia, that can come apart a little bit. So you can do something, and it will feel like, oh, I didn't do that. And you can imagine how all of these things can then lead to paranoia, because your reality is getting altered. And it's not the objective reality that's out there. That's something that's happening in your head. And if you are someone who is also capable of introspection and has, is fairly high functioning and is not completely debilitated by the schizophrenia, then you are in a worse quandary sometimes, because you're aware now that your reality could be something that is due to psychosis, but you're never quite sure when you're perceiving the real objective reality and when it's something that's being made up because of your schizophrenia. So you end up really struggling to make sense of your own reality.
We have just barely scratched the surface of the book. It's not that thick, honestly, but there's just so much stuff packed in here. It's fairly amazing. And I'll tell you that the opening anecdote, the opening story from long ago at the beginning of the book is really worth your time. The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. Anil Ananthaswamy wrote it and joined us on The Exchange today. Anil, thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.